Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man whose intelligence I have long respected, especially when it comes to matters involving this increasingly dynamic war, I think of, again, as the war for the free world, because that's what's at stake, is our first guest, Michael Waller. Professor Waller has been a teacher at the graduate level for many years. He has been an investigative reporter at terrific outlets like Washington Times Magazine Insight. He has been a colleague of mine at the Center for Security Policy, where he now serves as our Vice President for Government Relations, and an extraordinary friend as well. We're always glad to have him with us. Michael, welcome.
Good to be with you, Frank.
You have been specializing for decades on the old Soviet Union and more recently Russia, the relationship between the United States and the Kremlin, the kinds of activities that the Russians and before them the Soviets were up to. I'm fascinated to talk with you about all of that in connection with the meeting that is taking place about the time we're speaking, so we'll only be able to speculate about the meeting. But before we get to that, Mike, I wanted to just ask you for your thoughts about President Trump's, I think, rather remarkable speech in Warsaw that preceded his visit with Vladimir Putin and the G20 leaders.
It was an extraordinary speech. I think it'll wind up being a historic speech, and it's right up there with his extraordinary Riyadh speech. So if you take those two together in Riyadh and Warsaw, Trump is really laying the foundation for his vision of the world and the vision of making America great again and what America's role is in the world.
And how would you characterize that?
Well, it was a bold speech and it was a tough speech, but it wasn't the type of toughness that I think the media and the Europeans were expecting, meaning I'm going to impose my American values on the rest of the world kind of speech. It was a defense of Western civilization speech, which I don't think anybody was expecting. And he went to one of the most, the country in Europe with the strongest national identity, Poland, one of our most reliable NATO allies. He went there and stole the show from the rest of the G20 countries that were meeting today, saying that we, by putting America first, we don't mean imposing ourselves on the rest of the world. We want to stand with others who want to put their countries first, too, as long as we share the same values and as long as we're confident enough to believe in Western civilization. This was key, and it's driven a lot of the transnational types out of their minds because they can't defend Western principles. And here you have a president of the United States who's actually done it.
They don't, in fact, share our values. And I thought it was a particularly nice touch that he managed to stick it to them specifically in the list of bad guys that he wants to defend against by talking about all pervasive bureaucracy that is so much in evidence, particularly in Europe these days.
Oh, that drove the critics nuts because he put it on par with Russian imperialism, which he equated to the Nazis, and then to jihadism. And then he said, oh, by the way, be aware of this bureaucracy that's going to choke everybody's initiative. Western civilization wasn't built on paper and regulations. It was built on people pursuing their dreams and principles.
Well, let's turn to Putin and the meeting that he's having today with the president of the United States. But Michael, especially with your background in Kremlin watching and Kremlin countering, for that matter, talk a little bit about what baggage Vladimir Putin is bringing to this conversation that is clearly making it much more difficult for President Trump to try to forge a different kind of relationship with the Russians than the one that is likely in the offing now.
Well, first, Putin put himself in a corner by messing around in however he did in our electoral system by spying on us the way he has been doing in ways that completely transcend all norms of international behavior. So he has forced any president of the United States, but now especially this one, to take a really tough line. So while Trump says, hey, I want to have better relations with Moscow, really any American president should say that. Even Ronald Reagan did. But now Trump is saying, you screwed with our country. You screwed with me. I'm going to get you. And so that's kind of the atmosphere and the mood that Trump is in right now to go in to meet with Putin. And I think that's one of the reasons why Putin was so eager to have this meeting behind closed doors, because he doesn't know what to expect.
Mike Waller is our guest. And your thoughts about what Putin is doing in Russia at the moment that seems to be inspiring increasing opposition to his regime is something I'd like to touch on as well, Mike. Specifically, what I'm told in reporting in EurasiaNet that essentially the gulag is back in Russia these days, and that including the use of some techniques that the Soviets perfected, notably including psychiatric hospitals for the abuse of political prisoners. What can you tell us about that, and what kind of a window does that give us on Putin and his regime?
Well, first, this never really went away. The old Soviet secret police system and everything around it was never abolished during the Soviet collapse. This was one of the big criticisms of the Bush 41 administration, which really didn't want the Soviet Union to collapse. They tried to save it. And of the Clinton administration, whose policies ended up helping build the gangster state that begat Putin. So you have those factors there that made sure that the old Soviet control structures would remain in place. Now we're seeing news come out that the old system of psychiatric prisons is back. Well, really, it never went away. The Russians, who were some of the pioneers of modern psychology, are also the pioneers of psychiatric abuse and psychiatric torture in a really scientific way. And so what they're doing is they're using psychiatric prisons to discredit Putin's political opponents in public, to break them internally, to break their minds, to break their mental well-being, and to torture them using psychiatric torture, so that psychiatric torture can't be seen on the outside. And so they're judged mentally ill. So if an opponent of the government is judged mentally ill, then why should people listen to him? And so they're declared to have some kind of mental illness, including phobias that need medical treatment. But these phobias are also crimes.
Mike Waller, let me turn to one last thing. You were one of the first, I believe, to break the story that the FBI was treating Hillary Clinton's email system in a manner that raised serious questions about its forensic integrity, shall we say. This is borne out apparently in the treatment of the Democratic National Committee's email servers that you would have thought would have been very much subject to FBI investigation as part of their examination of the theory that the Russians were responsible for hacking into the DNC's systems. What can you tell us about this practice and the credibility of investigations absent firsthand review of the hardware and software itself?
Well, first, the top three or four levels of the FBI leadership have really discredited the whole bureau. They've become politicized. They've become both in a partisan level and on a cultural level of political correctness, which has pervaded the FBI from the top down. But there are a lot of great agents inside. What happened, though, was when this was Hillary's private server at her home in Chautauqua, New York, that was containing all this classified material that she was hiding as Secretary of State. The FBI didn't even try to sequester that computer. They didn't even ask her for it, for that server. When they had every right under the law to come in and seize it because it contained classified information. They didn't move on that until after I broke the story 2 years ago. that the FBI hadn't bothered yet to take the computer. And then the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal ran with it, and it became a national story after my Investor's Business Daily piece. And finally, the FBI did take the computer. But by then, it was really too late.
This is an issue that I know we're going to have to return to, Mike, and I hope we'll be able to do so with you. But thank you for your time and for the work you're doing for us at the Center for Security Policy. And we'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, we'll talk with Bill Gertz.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for our weekly visit, our guided tour, in fact, Inside the Ring, that being the title of the prize-winning column of its author, Bill Gertz, at the Washington Times. Bill is also the senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon and the author of 7 best-selling books, including most recently, I War, War and Peace in the Information Age. He's a regular contributor to us here at Secure Freedom Radio, and we're always glad to catch up with him. Bill, in New York, good to talk to you. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Bill, you called to my attention, and I think everybody else's, through the Free Beacon today, an important new publication of the Defense Intelligence Agency. I remember back in the day when I was a young man in the Pentagon, we used to produce Soviet military power. Russian military power is now out. And give us a quick overview of the insights that it provides.
Yeah, this is an important step forward for the U.S. government. For years, the Pentagon has forced the public to rely on Russian open sources. And now, for the first time, probably through congressional prodding, they've reintroduced this annual Russia military power report. To me, the biggest takeaway from the report is all of the details that it reveals about the use of information warfare. Again, this is a topic of my book, I War, but it really goes into great detail about how the Russians plan to use what Moscow terms information confrontation in the future conflicts, mostly with the United States. It also discusses Russia's aggressive nuclear buildup as well as its conventional force buildup. Contains a long historical section looking at how the Russian military declined after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 91, but is now making steps under Putin to again become a nuclear power and a threatening nuclear power that is going to project military power in its own area as well as around the world.
Yeah, so many key points here. And just to drill down for a moment on the I War piece of this, you quote my colleague who appears at the top of this program, Mike Waller, on the sort of important part that information warfare plays in a global psychological strategy of the Russians. Bill, describe a little bit how that works in operational practice.
Well, basically, it talks about, and again, this is a key point that I make in my book, I War. The DIA report goes in to talk about how it's not just the technical cyber aspects, which has been the primary focus of the U.S. government in countering cyber attacks and cyber espionage. It's now also what they call psychological warfare operations. That is the use of hacked information to influence publics and to manipulate public opinion around the world, the use of propaganda, media, lawfare, all these content-oriented tools that the Russians are using. And it's really important that we get a good understanding of this and then take steps to counter it. Hopefully, this report will be a good first step in doing that.
Bill, you've also reported this week about evidence that the North Koreans' new intercontinental range ballistic missile has a warhead that looks very much like one that the Chinese appeared to have supplied to Pakistan recently. Bill, we'll be talking momentarily with Gordon Chang. He has made the point that the Chinese seem to have provided the transporter erector launcher for these new North Korean missiles. And yet there still seems to be this hope that the Chinese will somehow engage in constraining the North Koreans, diminishing this threat. If anything, they seem to be exacerbating it. Am I missing something here?
Absolutely. And in fact, I think the Trump administration is recognizing that after the April summit in Mar-a-Lago, there was this grand hope that the Chinese were going to take steps to rein in the North Korean missile and nuclear program. And it's clear now that that's not the case. The launching of the ICBM on July 4th was a wake-up call for the fact that the Chinese are playing a double game. In other words, they're telling the U.S. that they're going to work with the American administration to try to deal with North Korea, and at the same time doing nothing to stop the flow of technology. And this is strategic missile technology in the form of launchers, perhaps even in the form of a multiple warhead, which I outline in my latest Washington Times Inside the Ring column this week.
Yeah, an intensifying threat, needless to say, if those ranges of the missiles become ever greater. Bill, you also mentioned something that I hadn't caught before, and that is that the North Korean trade with China had increased by 40%. In the first quarter of this year, a period when we were supposedly getting their help in trying to constrict this rogue regime that, let's face it, wouldn't be in business were it not for Chinese support.
Yeah, most people don't understand that China maintains a very broad defense treaty with North Korea. The relationship has been referred to, the Chinese-North Korean relationship has been referred to as close as lips and teeth. And I think that until that defense treaty is abrogated, it's foolish for any government, whether the U.S. or European or others, to think that China is going to be cooperative. So I think that the first step should be China should abrogate that defense treaty, and then we can look at whether or not there's any kind of a sincere effort on the part of Beijing to try to curb the nuclear and missile programs of North Korea, because they're becoming more dangerous. They're becoming an imminent threat. The launch of an ICBM capable, which took the Pentagon by surprise. There was no parade of this missile in advance, even though other long-range missiles have been shown off in military parades. This was a new ICBM.
Yeah, it is worrying that escape detection, but it's not the first time that our intelligence services have been surprised. Which brings me to my last topic, Bill Gertz, and that is the state of counterintelligence in the United States at the moment. You have a colleague, Adam Credo, at the Washington Free Beacon, a periodic guest here as well, who has a very important piece today reporting on analysis by the Senate Homeland Security Committee to the effect that there have been one leak per day during the life of the Trump administration of information, a lot of it out of the intelligence community, that is deemed to be capable of, well, compromising national security. To all of us who've been watching these leaks, I don't think that's really a surprise, but it does bespeak a serious counterintelligence problem, does it not?
Well, for many years, leaks to the press were not considered a counterintelligence issue, counterintelligence being the countering of foreign spy services. This is more of an internal security problem, and it's clear that the U.S. government has no internal security checks and safeguards that can prevent the kind of disclosures that we've seen just in the past few months, including the disclosure of sensitive personal information that was unmasked. I think this is a target of the House Intelligence Committee, which is focused on finding out whether or not the Obama administration in the persons of Susan Rice, John Brennan, and Samantha Power, the UN ambassador, were engaged in some type of improper intelligence operations against the Trump transition team. I think we're waiting to see the outcome of that investigation. And I think if they get the goods, they will show that there was such a program.
Thank you for your time today, my friend. As always, keep up the good work. Come back to us again very soon. We'll talk with Gordon Chang in a moment about the latest on China and North Korea as well, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It's my high pleasure to say, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by Gordon Chang, usually a little earlier in the week, but we missed him at the beginning of it. We're glad to catch up with him at its end. Gordon is, of course, one of the most effective, assiduous contributors to the public policy debate about Asia and U.S. interests and security concerns in that region in particular. He does all this through his platforms at The Daily Beast, where he writes a column, Forbes.com, missing WorldAffairsJournal.com, and of course Fox News and elsewhere. But we're most appreciative of him spending some time with us. Gordon, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Frank.
Let's talk, Gordon, about what you've been discussing a lot in the past few weeks, and that is the continuing and it seems accelerating threat North Korea poses to the United States. This was, of course, the subject of your terrific book, Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. I'm very interested in particular in the role that Communist China seems to be playing in intensifying that threat to not just our friends and allies and interests in the region, but to us here in the United States as well.
The missile that the North Koreans launched on July 4th, the Hwasong-14 as they call it, is carried on a Chinese transporter erector launcher. And I believe that President Trump in public should ask the Chinese, how come the North Koreans have Chinese and Chinese-looking missiles and equipment in their inventory? This is a continuing question because also, you know, we've seen that the missile that the North Koreans launched on August 24th, the one on February 12th, and the third one on May 21st look to be variants of China's JL-1 submarine-launched missile. This is important because those three missiles are solid fuel. It represents an important advance for North Korea's program, and it appears that the technology comes from China. I'm not saying that the Chinese definitely gave it to the North Koreans, but indeed, we need to hear an explanation from Beijing about this, because that's the most likely explanation for how the North Koreans got this Chinese technology.
And it certainly belies the idea that China wants to be helpful to us in restricting what the North Koreans are up to, or that at least they see a North Korean nuclear weapons program as a threat to them. These are, it seems, views that the president, Donald Trump, has now increasingly embraced after initially hoping that the Chinese might be helpful. You have done a very interesting piece in The Daily Beast earlier this week. I've been citing it all week long. We'll have to clean this up a little bit, but it cites an American official as saying that this has been, China month. Talk a little bit about, Gordon, the various ways in which the Trump administration seems to be saying to the Chinese, not just at a rhetorical or diplomatic level, but in terms they may actually understand and pay attention to, that we've had enough of this double game.
Yeah. Last week was an important pivot for American foreign policy because we saw President Trump move away from giving concessions to Beijing in order to win their cooperation to moving to imposing costs. So, for instance, on Monday, we had the president give a very warm welcome to the Indian Prime Minister, Narendra Modi. That was a signal to Beijing. On Tuesday, there was the State Department refusing to give China another waiver and dropping it to its worst category in its annual trafficking in persons report. Thursday was critically important. The Treasury Department took steps to sever a small fry Chinese bank, Bank of Dandong, from the global financial system. And indeed, that was the day we also saw that the White House notified an arms sale to Taiwan. And on Sunday, there was the second freedom of navigation operation in the South China Sea. You put that all together, this is not coincidence.
And certainly what the Trump administration is signaling to Beijing is that there are going to be costs. Those costs last week were in some sense minor ones, but the administration is apparently saying we can amp this up and make it very difficult for China to support North Korea. This is brilliant diplomacy on the part of President Trump from a number of different perspectives. And indeed, I hope that this is going to herald a decades-long path where we start to have a much more resolute policy with regard to Beijing.
I hope so too, Gordon. Let me ask you about one other aspect of this besides the question of whether or not it's getting the Chinese attention and likely to have a salutary effect on them, which I'd be interested in your thoughts on. But it certainly seemed to get the attention of the newly elected president of South Korea, President Moon, who was also in Washington last week. He sounded much more resolute than I remember him being on the campaign trail when he was running for office. Is that a coincidence or not?
Yeah, that, certainly it's not a coincidence that President Moon said things that he would have preferred not to say. Moon was resolute. He respected President Trump. We could see that in Moon's comments on America's strong foreign policy. Moon was elected on May 9th on basically domestic issues, but Moon is very much a pro-North Korean supporter, and certainly the advisors that he's picked are very much pro-North Korean. There's a real concern in Seoul, where we just were, that there will be a rupture in the relationship and the alliance. And what President Trump did in a brilliant tactical move was to signal that he was going to impose costs on China. That boxed in Moon. Therefore, he said some pro-American things that he was not inclined to say and probably did not plan to say. So this is, I think, very important diplomacy on the part of the Trump administration. It hasn't gotten credit for this for various reasons, but indeed, this is significant and I believe going to be a long-lasting trend as the United States works very hard to manage what is now a difficult ally in South Korea.
Well, I'm heartened to hear you say that it might actually have that result, Gordon, because I think you're right. This is a guy who has certainly indicated to this point that's not where he wants to go, and hopefully boxing him in will hold. But talk about China a little bit. Do you sense that they are beginning to shift on this policy of supporting the North Koreans essentially at all costs, blocking sanctions at the UN and the like? Or are the costs, or at least the signal that costs will be associated with their double game, actually beginning to, you know, get their attention?
I think we are getting their attention. There was a significant phone call on Sunday between President Trump and Xi Jinping, and it, I think, illustrates the nature of the relationship between the U.S. and China. Many people thought that Xi was so upset at the U.S. that he would not take President Trump's call, because Trump did try to arrange this call over the weekend. And Chinese observers were surprised that Xi, in fact, took the call. And I think that's because Xi understands that U.S. power over China is overwhelming. He is not in a position to take on the U.S. And that contradicts a lot of narratives in our country that China owns the 21st century and that we have to respect the Chinese and get along with them. Trump has shown that the exercise of U.S. power can push China in better directions. Now, I don't think that China has pivoted on North Korea yet. This is still very early because we're only talking about days. But nonetheless, there are some very hopeful signs that Trump was able to do something that nobody thought anyone in the U.S. could do. And so, therefore, I'm hopeful that we are on a path. But, of course, this is still very early days, Frank, and it's going to require all that you can do to make sure that this goes on a better way for us.
Well, most especially anything and everything that you can do, Gordon Chang, through your various very important platforms. Thank you for including these among them and for joining us for this important update. We'll look forward to hearing what your thoughts are after this G20 meeting that the president will be interacting a bit with President Xi in, as well as the Russians, with North Korea as one of the topics for discussion. That will await us till next week, though. In the meantime, Gordon, thanks for your time today. Keep up the great work, my friend. Come back to us again soon. Next up, Luke Rosiak of the Daily Caller joins us to talk about the IT scandal on Capitol Hill. that you may not have heard about. More on that straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I am thrilled to say we are joined by Luke Rosiak, a man whose determination, enterprise, and rigor in covering a most important story that is largely otherwise not getting the sort of attention it deserves is the kind of thing that I hope will ultimately get him a Pulitzer Prize, but at the very least it earns him our great respect. Luke Rosiak is his name. These days he is an investigative reporter at the Daily Caller. His beat includes and is much consumed at the moment with a story that, as I say, I think is of the first order importance, but has largely been neglected by official Washington on both sides of the aisle. That is a scandal associated with 20 or more members of the House Democratic Caucus on Capitol Hill and some of the people they have employed over the past few years to provide IT, information technology services. We are anxious to get an update on this story. There's seemingly always something new, and Luke Rosiak is bringing it to us. Luke, thank you so much for taking a few minutes to brief us on what the latest is.
Thanks, Frank.
We have so many different angles on this story, Luke. Maybe I could just ask you to sort of update us on sort of the cast of characters. Who were the folks providing these IT services, and why is there reason to be concerned about
them? Well, you remember that 5 months ago now, Capitol Police told members of Congress that five of their IT guys were being banned from Congress because they were suspected of taking part in a serious information breach as well as theft. That was Imran Awan, his wife Hina Alvi, his brothers Jamal Awan and Abid Awan. And then recently I revealed that they also had this other guy, Hasib, who basically was the guy who had to do all the work. And it turned out that the rest of them were basically like ghost employees. And this guy Hasib was the one who wasn't even making much money, but he had to come in and do all the IT work for some 20 members of Congress while the other guys got paid.
And got paid handsomely, as I understand it, at that.
Yeah, they got paid, you know, $160,000 each, which is chief of staff level salary. It's not really the salary for an IT guy. It's very unusual. And then they also had this guy, Rau Abbas, who was Imran's best friend and, you know, lived in his house. And supposedly this guy was like working at McDonald's while he was on the payroll for, you know, these members of Congress supposedly doing IT. So
till he got fired, apparently. So when you describe these individuals, not only that the most, if not all of them, hail from Pakistan, and they have been getting immense amounts of money for what seems to be not much evident work in connection with information technology support to members of Congress on a variety of very sensitive committees on Capitol Hill. The question occurs, are these people of good character? And based on your reporting, Luke Rosiak, at the Daily Caller, there's a lot of reason to believe they're not. Give us a little bit of the flavor of that, if you would.
Well, certainly the IT guys, these are the ones who set up the email accounts for members and their staff, and they can absolutely read every single email that was sent and received by the members of Congress that they worked for. You know, that's something that everyone has acknowledged, but people have downplayed, you know, the obvious risk that that poses. So when you've got these guys who have full access to members of Congress's emails being accused of crimes, it's like,
they would do certain bad things for money, would that also include using their emails for bad purposes?
Or simply selling them to people who might be interested in knowing, not necessarily classified information, because presumably that's not supposed to be on these servers, but nonetheless, information that would be sensitive and perhaps compromising for these members of Congress, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I would certainly assume that really any of us, whether politician or not, if you read someone's emails, you're going to find some things that are embarrassing and it could potentially be used for blackmail or, you know, who knows what else. If someone has full access to your emails and then they get in trouble, I mean, it's kind of like the screws are turning on you a little bit. Those people have potential leverage over you.
And Luke, I mean, again, in addition to allegedly having stolen government computers and machinery and having perhaps improper access to information they shouldn't have. These are individuals that your reporting suggests have been engaged in things perhaps involving insurance fraud and extortion and, you know, shakedowns of family members and threats of various kinds that just bespeak, it seems to me, a counterintelligence problem of a rather significant kind. And yet, as I said, that's not seemingly how this case is being treated. Am I missing something?
I think that's right. It's odd enough that, you know, the Capitol Police have said that, you know, this is a security breach situation. These emails, they potentially, you know, did illegal stuff on the House network. It's surprising enough that members of Congress aren't in an uproar about that. In fact, members like Gregory Meeks of New York have said, I don't think they would do anything nefarious, was his words. And he said he hasn't seen a smoking gun. And, you know, a couple other members have, you know, kind of conveyed similar things that these guys are good guys.
Debbie Wasserman Schultz, notably, you've reported, has been rather defensive of them at that, hasn't she?
Yeah, I mean, Politico has described Imram as being friends with Gregory Meeks and Wasserman Schultz, which is kind of weird for the IT guy to be friends with members of Congress. And Wasserman Schultz hasn't fired him, even though he's an IT guy who's not allowed to touch computers anymore.
At $160,000 a year, she's still paying him? Can you tell?
They work for multiple members, so each member probably pays them maybe $20,000 each, and they may work for eight members each. So it adds up that way. But, you know, they say, oh, it's just they're probably not that bad people. Maybe they stole some money. Maybe it's just a minor thing. But when you look at these guys and every single aspect of their life has massive red flags. They're being sued in Fairfax County, Virginia right now over alleged insurance fraud, where the allegations are that they threatened to kidnap people in Pakistan if they didn't, you know, if they didn't turn over basically, they wanted their stepmom to sign a power of attorney that would give them money that's stored over in Pakistan. And, you know, their dad died and they basically shook down the dad. They took all of his assets, really, which made their stepmom homeless.
What I can't quite figure out is why the Republican leadership of the House of Representatives is seemingly, well, if not indifferent to this drama, certainly lowballing it as well. Do you have an explanation for that?
I don't have an explanation, but I think it's true. I mean, Republicans control, you know, the committees. They've just been saying, you know, the Capitol Police are handling this investigation. But my latest story on the dailycaller.com shows that there's very clear evidence that anyone can see, any cops could have found very quickly, as I did, anyone you talk to who deals with these guys. The evidence points to them engaging in tax fraud, extortion, bankruptcy fraud, and insurance fraud, as well as other things. Every single aspect of their lives seems to be motivated by lies, corruption, and the relentless pursuit of money. And these things are basically all outside of the Capitol Police's jurisdiction. But there's also the question of members' actions, which may not, you know, be criminal. But how did these guys wind up on members' payrolls when not all of them were showing up for work? And that's the kind of thing that members are kind of well-equipped to investigate among themselves. It's not really something that the police can do or anything. It's more of an administrative internal matter.
Luke Rosiak, thank you for the terrific work you do at the Daily Caller, most especially on this story, but on so many others of interest to us as well. Come back to us again very soon with updates, and let's hope we can get the Congress actually investigating this scandal itself at last.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Our guest is Frank Calzone. He is a man that I've come to admire greatly for his deep, firsthand, and committed, principled opposition to the Castro regime and what it has done to the people of his native land, Cuba, over many decades. These days, he is the executive director of the Center for a Free Cuba, an extraordinarily important organization helping the rest of us understand ground truth in Cuba at the moment. Frank Calzone, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Thank you very much.
You know, I'd like to start this conversation about sort of the U.S.-Cuba relationship at the moment under Donald Trump by just reminding our listeners of what it was that Barack Obama bequeathed as his legacy in that regard. I know you've been deeply critical of it, as have I, but remind us of what Obama did and its repercussions.
Well, Mr. Obama put in place an American policy that was a result of his worldview and had very little to do with American interests or the rights of the Cuban people. Mr. Obama encouraged tourism to Cuba. Tourism, according to the law, it's illegal. And Mr. Obama went ahead and tried to change, get around it by calling tourists something else, by calling it people to people or travel for scientific or religious purposes. It was similar to what he did on Iran, that the United States could not send dollars to the Ayatollahs, but Mr. Obama said, well, the thousands, the billions of dollars we're sending to Tehran are not really dollars. We change them into euros or something else. It's based on a lie, and so far, very little advantageous to the United States has come out of either one of those deals.
Well, now you're putting it rather charitably. In fact, is it not the case, Frank Calzone, that the upshot of these so-called people-to-people exchanges or tourism by any other name has been to greatly enrich and otherwise benefit the Cuban military and intelligence services and the like?
You're exactly right, and President Trump understand that. And what happens is that the tourist industry is overwhelmingly under the control of the Cuban military. The same military, I might add, that is, as we speak, repressing and killing Venezuelan demonstrators in Caracas. The Trump administration has announced the president's policy of trying to curtail the amount of funds that go into the Cuban military. But it's hard to predict what's going to happen under President Trump until the regulations are put in place and until the staff is finally put in key positions of administration.
One of the things that you touched on there is so important, of course, is that the Cuban sort of foreign legion or police services are helping suppress those aspiring to freedom in Venezuela. And yet, even though that's going on, despite other activities that are very much inimical to, I believe, Western interests, not just those of the United States, the European Union is pursuing a pact with the Cuban government that can only have the effect, it seems, of perpetuating it, propping it up, enriching it. What are the Europeans thinking, for heaven's sake?
Well, diplomatic initiatives take a long time to come to fruition. And what we're seeing in Europe, what we saw earlier this week, is the end or the completion of something that President Obama has been working for a long time, which is to bring the European policy toward Cuba in line to what Mr. Obama had in place, which is to give to the Castro government whatever the Castro government wanted, and not to condition anything on an improvement of the human rights situation in Cuba. It is shocking that while President Trump in Poland talked a couple of days ago about the alliance, the need for America's allies in Europe to work together with the United States to advance the common interest, the Europeans are now providing additional benefits, or announcing that they will provide additional benefits to the Castro government right at the time when the whole world is looking at North Korea and the missile. Because Castro, Raul Castro, is a good ally of North Korea, 90 miles away from the United States. Havana attempted less than 2 years ago to send missiles and warplanes to North Korea. So helping the Castro government at the time when we're all concerned about North Korean missiles, without realizing that Havana was sending warplanes to North Korea not too long ago, is very disturbing.
No, it's a very troubling relationship, but so is the relationship between Cuba and one of North Korea's other principal sponsors, namely Russia. And remind us what's going on, Frank Calzone, with respect to the seeming reactivation of the relationship between the Russian intelligence services and the Cubans. Again, for the purpose of monitoring and stealing our secrets and otherwise undermining our security.
I am sure some of your listeners remember that at the end of the so-called Cold War, the Russian presence in Cuba was brought to an end. Now, under Mr. Obama, that situation was reversed. And while the United States and President Obama were negotiating with Raul Castro's son, who happens to be a lieutenant colonel in Cuba's spy agency, while those negotiations were taking place, Havana welcomed back into Havana's harbor Russian spy ships who go there to monitor American military communications. And also, the Havana has asked the Russians to start discussing about setting up or reopening a spy base near the city of Havana.
Frank, among other reasons, the ones we've discussed, you have called for the United States to respond by restoring Cuba to the state sponsor of terrorism list. Talk a little bit about why that's in order and whether you think under Donald Trump's relook at this misbegotten policy of Obama's, that might happen.
Well, President Trump spoke in Miami a few days ago, and he mentioned the issue of American terrorists who receive safe haven in Cuba. The president has ordered the FBI and the Justice Department to prepare a report on American fugitives in Cuba that he will have to review. What happened under President Trump was that Raul Castro told the United States that he would not go along with reestablishing normal diplomatic relations with Washington unless Cuba was brought out of the infamous list of countries that support terrorism. Mr. Obama went ahead and did what Raul Castro asked him to do. Apparently, the president didn't know or didn't want to know at the time, President Obama, that there were terrorists in Havana. When Mr. Obama took Cuba out of the terrorist list, the FBI at the same time was offering and continues to offer $1 million for the information leading to the capture of these American terrorists.
Frank Calzone, thank you for being the conscience of our country on this very important topic of the need for the liberation of Cuba from the Castros. The work you do at the Center for a Free Cuba is really important and deeply valued by all of us. I hope you'll come back to us with further reporting on it very soon.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.